Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Helen Holliman, and I'm back for another week of radio in the back of Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And today I've got a really awesome guest. I've got Matt Ducker from NBC's The Feast. Matt, thanks for joining the show.
It's good to be here.
Can you hear yourself?
I can hear myself. No, this is great.
Okay, good. I can sort of hear myself in the headphones. So if I'm talking really loud, you'll know why. So Matt is the food editor of The Feast. And for those listeners out there who are living under a rock, can you explain what The Feast is?
Sure. So The Feast is a food and restaurant focused website. We also have a shopping and a nightlife section as well. But I'm responsible for the food portion of the site. And basically we cover, you know, all things food and restaurants here in New York, as well as 10 other cities around the country. We put a special focus on video and photo multimedia stuff to just kind of tell some interesting stories that are a little bit outside of the everyday minute micro focused blog coverage that's out there and that other people are doing so well. So just trying to focus on those fun chefs and restaurateurs and the people behind the restaurants, the bussers, the bar backs, whoever's a story we want to go tell it. So that's kind of what we're doing.
Well, and just to look at your background, I mean, you've written for Eater, Curbed. I also read that you're writing a food gadget section of the Netted newsletter, which sounds awesome. And you're also extremely young. You're 23,
that's
a young, dapper gentleman.
Okay.
And which is very rare in this industry. And I sort of want, for listeners out there, explain how you got into the food media industry in the first place.
Sure. So I am young. Thank you. Good to lead with.
It's a good thing. It's a great thing.
So I started out, I'm from Southern California, from Orange County. It's, about an hour south of Los Angeles. You know, not exactly the culture capital of the world. And I moved to New York to go to school at NYU to study screenwriting at Tisch. And I've always been interested in telling stories. I was like very active in high school with video production and doing like short documentary films, which is sort of what I'm doing now. But I started out, working when I came to New York, working for The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, for some other film production related jobs. But I started out in food as an intern at Eater, which is a popular blog here in New York that covers restaurants like no other. It's certainly the best. It's the gold standard. And Amanda Clute, who's the editor over there, is fantastic. And
she's the best.
I'm sure she'd be a great guest on your show one day and has a lot of amazing things to say. But I started there as an intern. And it wasn't with the goal of turning it into some sort of career. I was interested in how online media was working and how that was going to, sort of make its way into being a part of the film industry. And I thought that, it was down to two internships. I applied to Eater and I applied to Gizmodo, which are pretty, pretty damn different. but I ended up really liking what they were doing at Eater and what Amanda was doing. And she gave me a lot of freedom to kind of do you know, to help her with intern tasks, but also do things that I wanted. I ran a series there called The Gatekeepers while I was there, which we go to restaurants and talk to GMs and maitre d's about, you know, how to get a table and, you know, just the crazy stories they've heard. So she let me really do some fun things and kind of get into the world. And I met a lot of chefs and I met a lot of restaurateurs and really, I think to work in any sort of media and especially food media, you really need to, you know, it's not a glamorous life, you know, it's a daily grind, especially online, and you need to love what you do. And I love restaurants and I love the world of restaurants, and not even, I don't write about food really. I write about restaurants and how they work. And, it's not really about, I love eating, you know, if I come to Roberta's, I love having pizza and, you know, all the great house cured meats and stuff that they do. But, it's really about, like, you know, the intricacies of how restaurants come together and what it takes for that to happen and everything that happens behind the scenes, all the characters. And so that's really what Eater showed me, because they really are tapped into that. You know, it's not fluffy lifestyle, you know, BS. It's real, you know, what's going on minute by minute. So that's kind of how I got tuned into things. And then Ben Leventhal called me one day and wanted me to start out as a contributor on this new site he was starting at the time called The Feast. And I signed on as like to do two posts a day or something. And it ended up kind of developing from there to where I am now.
So, you know, in 365 days a year, how many nights would you estimate you're eating out?
You know, I'm trying to eat out less these days. I'm trying to cook more. You know, at first, like, you know, it's, you have the temptation to eat out all the time, you know, and of course, like, I love being a regular, at restaurants. I love eating in my neighborhood at places like, eat at Back 40 quite a bit. I eat at Frankie 17. I live in the East Village.
You're an East Villager.
I am
okay.
An East Villager. Yes. And so I eat out quite a bit. But I mean, you know, I'm probably eating out, like, you know, unfortunately, like 3 to 4 days a week, you know, for part of work. And you just, you know, it's a great thing, but it's also, you know, it gets tough to do that all the time. Yeah, that sounds like I'm sounding
no,
silly.
No,
but
I mean, it's like any job sometimes, you know. Yeah, I get it.
But I do like cooking, and I cook simple things at home. And you know, while I don't cover food per se, I do think it's to know, like, to even cook something simple at home and to have an understanding of how that works. You know, and it's hard for me to even roast chicken at home, to put that in the context of what chefs do every single night. And I shoot a lot in kitchens, a lot of video and a lot of photos in kitchens. And I like see what these chefs do and how these restaurants kind of come together. And it really gives you an appreciation for what these guys do every single night. It's really insane. It's a tough industry. And the further you get into it as a journalist, I think the more you kind of understand, like how difficult.
Yeah. It's
it really
like
is.
Being on a professional sports team or something. It's so physical. But what do you like to cook when you're at home?
What do I like to cook? You know, I cook a lot of chicken. I cook a lot of, I think, but you know, I do, I love ordering chicken in restaurants. I love roast chicken. It's one of my favorite things. I love going to Balthazar and getting roast chicken there. And I think it's, you know, I've people will say that that's a true test of a restaurant. It requires patience, and it's not a quick fire dish that they can, you know, has a 2 minute pickup time. It's something that takes time and care. And so I like it, but chicken is also simple and, you know, somewhat healthy. And, you know, I just sauteed chicken with mushrooms and Brussels sprouts or whatever, you know, and some sriracha, because that's trendy.
That's the secret ingredient.
Super cool. Yeah. So that's what I do. I cook that a lot. You know, I cook some pasta, just simple stuff at home. Nothing insane. You know, I used to be really, I still like cookbooks, but I used to like to cook really elaborate things, you know, cause I would try to replicate what I was eating out so much. But now I really just like appreciating simple food at home. So
totally. Well, so, all right. So speaking of The Feast, I noticed today that you guys, I think it was today, you mentioned Cheap Eats,
okay,
places to go. And I kind of wanted to hear from you, like, some of your favorite, restaurants on that list and sort of why.
Let's see. I think Porchetta, like, has headlined Cheap Eats in New York for the last, you know, feel like 3 years, but it's definitely one of my favorite places. And Sarah Jenkins is a fantastic chef, and her restaurant Porsena that opened nearby isn't, you know, it's not really Cheap Eats. It's not, you know, $10 and under, which is what I consider, you know, cheap, but she does an amazing job. You know, I love Vanessa's Dumplings. I love going there. That's kind of near my neighborhood.
What do you like to get there?
Dumplings and the scallion pancakes, you know.
Yeah, those are killer. No, and they're so cheap.
And I love Chinatown. I love going out, and I've, you know, I have a lot of friends who are sommeliers and work in the wine world, and it's a huge favorite among Soms because BYOB is such a wonderful thing, you know. And so, like, going down to Fulin Seafood and, like, just picking out on, like, those small shrimp that they do, and, you know, bringing some Riesling or whatever, or going to Golden Unicorn or, you know, any of those great spots, it's really fun, you know. And I think it's important to have that balance between, you know, like those fine dining meals that we love, and I love that kind of pomp and that circumstance, but going, you know, and being able to go to Chinatown and do BYOB and have that be just as important of experience, you know, is really important, I think, in New York, you know.
Have you been to a Namwa Tea Parlor?
No, I haven't been there. Tell me about it, please.
It's incredible. And for listeners out there too, if you haven't been,
where is that located?
Check it out. It's on Doyer Street, okay. I believe.
It's a mess down there. I don't really know what that means, Doyer Street.
Yeah,
that's somewhere.
Me neither. I mean, I'm sort of 10 minutes away, but it's basically this block that they claim is one of the oldest blocks in New York because it has this very strange angle to it. And they say that the gangs of New York used to fight on this street because on one side, you can't see who's coming, which is terrifying. But this tea parlor is amazing. It is kind of stuck in 1950s sort of decor in the best way possible. And it's very sort of Chinese American dim sum, if you will. And it's been passed down through this family. And it's just a very unique place that I think captures a different time capsule, as we were talking about earlier, in Chinatown. And it's more of the atmosphere that I really go for, but you should totally check it out.
Yeah.
So yeah, so okay. So those are some interesting spots. I'm glad we agree on Vanessa's dumplings.
No, it's good. And let me be clear, the 14th Street location is not what we're talking about when we talk about Vanessa's.
Are you talking Lower East Side?
Lower East Side only.
Yeah. I'm glad you clarified that.
Well, I mean, just that's important.
So it's a little, yeah. And now they're opening one in Williamsburg.
And I'm not sure what's happening with, like, who's running that, what's going on. I'm very suspicious.
Is it like Subway where you just
I think it's
franchise.
A franchise. I think it's a Vanessa's dumpling franchise. Yeah.
I don't know about that. All right. So one of the things that I'm sort of curious about from your perspective as well is, you know, obviously since part of your job is mapping out what's happening within restaurant culture in New York, what are people currently serving that you notice that possibly reflects what's going on within our social culture? Like guilty pleasures or...
You know, I think that whole comfort food movement is very much still alive. And we were kind of talking about this before we started that New York seems to be stuck in a little bit of a rut with a lot of the same sort of restaurants opening. And I think this fall preview season was sort of, in recent memory for me, was one of the thing that was like kind of the most glaring, where there was really nothing that stood out that was something new and completely different. You know, you have new restaurants opening, great new restaurants, but I was at a loss for when people asked me what the opening of the fall would be. And you know, those things often like develop and creep up anyway in normal seasons, but there was no obvious answer. And I was saying that I kind of lack the historical perspective to really say if this is not just something that happens every, you know, decade or so, but it really does seem like we're still in a recession. We may be out of, you know, getting out of it, but that's very much in the forefront of people's minds. And the restaurants that are opening right now, you know, were probably planned in 2009, right after the recession. And so I think we're still getting like a serious product of like that sort of thinking. You know, people really dressing down what they're doing. You have places like, you know, you have Ed Schoenfeld's place with Joe over at Red Farm, you know, which is really like, you look at what they did at Chinatown Brasserie and now what they're doing at Red Farm. This is 40 seats. They, you know, they barely could open it. They didn't have enough seats to even like, you know, make sense for their business plan. They had to take some space out of the hallway of the building next door in order to add 10 more seats to make it like financially viable. And I mean, Ed's been opening restaurants, you know, for 40 years
forever
in New York,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And people like him are even like, this is what we need to be doing. So, I mean, it's a serious, and that restaurant's been in the works for about 2 years, you know? And so things are really, seems like they're still trending in that direction. And I'm not really sure when we're going to get out of it. I mean, this year, those big flashy openings are all coming from foreign chefs. Like, you have Gaston Acurio, who's opening Lamar. You have Miguel Sanchez Romero, who's opening that crazy restaurant
that,
last night.
$245.
Yeah. Yeah, I interviewed him a couple of days ago. That was interesting.
Yeah.
But the people that are taking these risks, I'm not so sure that they are 100% aware of the market they're getting into. And so I don't know if that says something about what's going on in New York food, that the only people that are seeming to really invest some big money and come in are people that are essentially foreigners. Outsiders.
I kind of like that.
So I don't know.
It's like getting married to someone marrying someone, falling in love, and then being like, oh, wait, I haven't met your family. Or
right. You know,
it's like, oh, it's a little bit of a gamble.
I like where you're going with that.
Yeah, you like
good.
That? Yeah, it's a little awkward, a little creepy.
No, it's good.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we get back, we have more from Matt Ducker of NBC's The Feast. You're listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. Stay tuned. Listening to You Look Hungry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm still your host, Helen Holliman, and if you're just tuning in, I'm joined today by Matt Ducker of NBC's TheFeast.com. And before the break, we were talking about a bunch of things going on in the New York restaurant world and the scene, and there's a very excited lumberjack-looking man waving at us.
Have you described what the setup is like before to people on the
show? It's a very wild and crazy setup.
Essentially, we're here in the back of Roberta's in their unair-conditioned back room. This is a converted shipping cargo thing.
Totally.
So we're back here, and there's this glass window, and we can basically see everybody. And there was a large bearded man who came up to the glass and was, I don't know what he was doing, but he was something.
He was really
excited. So we can see everything here. This is great. This is really voyeuristic and fun.
That was almost as good. There was one show when I interviewed Das Racist. There was a little chubby 8-year-old boy who lifted his shirt and rubbed his nipples against the glass.
I imagine that happens a lot.
It was just very apropos for that day. But anyway, so okay, you chose the song, which we both love.
So that was M83's Midnight City, and it's coming off their new album that's coming out, I think, later this month. It's called Don't Wake Me, I'm Dreaming, or something like that. Something awesome, something epic. But that song I figured if I was really bombing in the first half of the show, listening to that would really pump me up for the second half. So I don't know, you know, I'll leave that up to everybody else how the first half went, but I think that was a good, that's what I wanted out of that.
I really like the end with the saxophone vibes.
Yeah, it's awesome.
It reminds me, have you seen Saxophone Man on YouTube?
I haven't seen that.
All right. Do yourself a favor and just, I would say if you're in some sort of friendly revenge, I would probably hire him because
I labored over that song choice though. I really do think, do people talk about that? Like you emailed me and you asked me to pick a song for the commercial for the midpoint. And I was torn between something classic or something new, like something I feel like it makes a statement about me. But I just decided just to be primal, and just that song gets me amped. So that's what I went with.
It makes me want to jazzercise. Yeah. I don't even jazzercise. My mom does. And every time I go home, she tries to make me do it. Anyway, all right. So we were talking before a little bit about, you know, like what's happening in the restaurant scene. Something I I'm curious to hear your thoughts on is like all of these pop-up markets and pop-up, mm-hmm. like I live by the San Gennaro Festival on Mulberry Street, which I probably shouldn't say to my creepy listeners who will come find me. But
I think you're safe. That's a large area.
It's a large area.
Yeah, I think it'll be okay.
But, you know, the Terese boys have totally kind of made sort of repurposed part of that fair.
Right.
They've got Parm opened up at Yankee Stadium, and then we've also got the whole like sports fan revamps at like Madison Square Garden, and so there's all these different festivals and whatever. What do you think all of this is about, and do you think this is just like a temporary trend, or do you think it'll stay around?
I mean, let's talk specifically about the Terese guys and what they're doing. I think it's very exciting, and those guys, I've been following them since they opened Terese as a lunch spot, and then eventually they did dinner, and it wasn't always the instant hit that it is today, and like those guys are so successful and they deserve it. Seems like it's a labor of love. They're not doing this to make money off those stands out there, you know, and this year they've for people that don't know what we're talking about, they've gotten some chefs like April Bloomfield from the John Doe Oyster Bar in the Breslin and Spotted Pig, and Emma Hurst from Stellina. You have Ruby Rosa, those guys, and they've kind of taken over two blocks or two tents right in front of Terese at the San Gennaro Festival, and kind of tried to break up the monotony of sausages and
Zeppole
and all that stuff. And they're doing something cool, and I think it's amazing. And I think people have been talking for years about how to, within respect to street food and those street fairs, those horrible street fairs that happen every weekend, which is really like San Gennaro continued indefinitely, you know, like roasted corn and whatever uninspired things. And, and people have been talking about how to make those, more of something that people in the city actually want to go do instead of just tourists and whoever else comes in to buy that stuff. And I think they found a way to do it, to take, you know, identifiable characters and restaurant people that people want to go see. I mean, like it's pretty cool to go and be able to talk to April or whatever, if she's there, or just try her food in that kind of accessible, like no frills environment. I don't think she's going to be opening any like food stands anytime soon where you can try her whatever for $5. So I think it's a really attractive way. I think it's hard to sustain that sort of thing. You know, I think part of the reason why this works is because it's a low commitment. Like, you know, it only goes on for how long is that? A couple weeks? The festival?
It ends this weekend sometime.
So, I mean, how do you kind of find a middle ground to make that kind of solution work long term? I'm not sure. But, I think the things that are happening at the airports and the Madison Square Garden and Citi Field and Yankees and like these licensing deals or whatever that they've been able to do. Like, you know, I don't think that Rich and Mario from Terese are at Parm every single time at Yankee Stadium, but they have one of their guys out there. They have oversight. Their name is on it. So there's some level of responsibility. And I think that's a good middle ground, you know, and I think that's what people want, you know, as food culture awareness kind of raises more and more every day. You know, I think people really want to have that kind of quality food options around. And I mean, just this week, the Madison Square Garden revamp that got announced. I mean, you're going to have Andrew Carmelini there, Drew Nuperant doing burgers, and, Jean Georges. Like, I mean, it's really fantastic. I think it's great, you know, and it'll be interesting to see, like, I don't know, at MSG, like how... I think you still need some of that other old school stuff. You know, you still need some of that nasty stuff. I don't know,
man.
But so I hope it's not like an over gentrification or over cleanly, you know, squeaky clean overhaul of all these things. I hope there's, you know, some of New York still is that sort of disgusting Third Avenue street fair. You know, like, you know, there still needs to be some of that. But that's why I think the San Gennaro thing is great, because it's this one little block, and if you want to do that, you go there, and that's your experience, and you can walk down and do whatever you need to. But if your memories of San Gennaro are that disgusting, you know, whatever, or you know that generic Italian American fair, then that's your experience, and you go do that. And I think that's awesome.
Yeah, well, because you know the Terese duo is interesting too, you know, in the same point, like in Lucky Peach issue number one, they talk about how to save the neighborhood by updating it sort of, and what does that mean? And sort of, there's also been a lot of talk like, oh, well, if we add this high quality food to Yankee Stadium, is that a gentrification? And Does this dismiss baseball culture of the past, like those watery hot dogs and beer? And so
that's where I think there does need to be that middle ground. And I think that needs to be, you know, a compromise, and those people need to be, you know, they haven't talked about the prices for this new Madison Square mm-hmm. revamp yet, but I, you know, they're saying that they don't want things to go over $10 or whatever, but you really can't put things out of reach for people that are going to those events, and you know, like they're have the nosebleeds at the Knicks, and like they're not able to eat anything because everything is $20 for dinner. Or then those, you know, they keep the prices low, but the seat prices raise or whatever to make up for it. So I feel like you can't just completely throw out an old system and put in, you know, all these chef-driven concepts, because it's not necessarily what everybody wants. But I certainly think it seems like a step in the right direction, and they might have to scale things back. But, you know, people seem excited to be doing these sorts of projects right now, and it's lucrative for chefs and restaurateurs, obviously, to go in and do these things. But
I think they're just doing it so they can get baseball tickets for the full season.
It?
I think that's the real secret no one's talking about.
No, it's good. Scandal.
You know, scandal. So, yeah, and we were also talking before we actually went on air. About
we had a whole interview before we went on air.
It was so much better than
what's
happening
right now.
Did we
tape that? Was that? No, it was, guys, it was, trust us, it was, like, totally better.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
We were talking a little bit before we recorded about, you know, this idea of there's been some classic, if you will, restaurants and bars, whatever, in the past couple of years who have closed their doors due to high rent or lease issues. One of the places I'm talking about is Elaine's. If you don't know Elaine's, it's a joint that was featured in Manhattan by, you know, my male alter ego in terms of my neurotic self, Woody Allen. So anyway,
I don't really see that, by the way. I'm not sure if that's apt,
it's only in my head when I start to, like, you know, use hand sanitizer and things like that.
All right.
Getting a little crazy.
Go on.
But the point is, you know, is it good or bad? Like, is the rent too damn high? Is it just the way Manhattan is and people just want new things all the time? Should we preserve places like Elaine's, or should we just keep going?
Well, I mean, you know, again, I feel, you know, it's, I don't know if I'm the appropriate person to talk to in terms of, you know, my perspective. I can only talk about what I've experienced, but with Elaine's, I distinctly remember my one and only meal at Elaine's, and it wasn't at the end. It wasn't the last night. It wasn't in its glory. I saw it, about four or five years ago. And I didn't really know what Elaine's was. It was before I was in the food world at all or really knew much about New York restaurants. And I went to Elaine's with a friend who had been coming to New York for years. He kind of explained what an institution it was to me, you know, that it was in Manhattan, and it's been all these movies, and, you know, the writers and media people used to come here. And it didn't seem to me, it wasn't a place where I immediately realized that, where I sensed that, you know, I think that Elaine's, like, you know, it was open for a long time and ran a fantastic course, and it was a piece of, you know, New York culture. But when she passed away, I don't know what the other logical conclusion. I mean, it turns into some sort of, like, weird museum where, you know, she wasn't there, and people like sit around reminiscing about the memories of what Elaine's was. I mean, I think New York is about, you know, there are those landmarks that stay open, like the, you know, the Carlyle Club and places like that people go to, like, have that experience. And that's the specific reason you go there. It's not about the food or the drink or whatever. It's about going and being in that room or with those people or remembering those experiences. But with Elaine specifically, I mean, it really seems like it would have been a disservice to her and what the restaurant was to keep it running in some sort of amusement park-esque way, you know, just like as a time capsule. So, and I mean, we were also talking about La Bernardine, which just closed for the month of August and opened back up and went through a similar kind of effort to not become what Elaine's could have been, with some museum, some time capsule. And obviously La Bernardine is a 4-star restaurant, and it was packed every single night, and so it's completely different from Elaine's. But Eric Repair was talking to me so much about how he had a strong desire to move forward. And that La Bernardine, you know, contrary to what people think now, it has evolved over time, and it wasn't always what it was right before it closed. It wasn't just some restaurant that was stuck in time for 25 years, but sometimes to make people really realize the changes and the changes in your philosophy that have kind of been there behind the scenes the whole time, you need to make some kind of big statement. And I think they've done that very successfully. I don't know if you saw the photos of the revamp or the videos that we did. Yeah,
it's great. You should check it out. Sure.
but they really managed to toe the line and keep it classic, but modern and beautiful. I think that was really successful. So, I think it's a good question. You know, about how to stay modern and how, you know, what's important to hold on to and which landmarks do we keep, which do we let go. I don't know if there's any like hard fast rule or line about how that works, but
well, apparently Roberta's is doing it too, because they're doing construction as we speak.
Yeah, what's going on?
What I don't know. I think they're going to take apart this radio station and we'll be exposed to the outside world in just a minute. No, I don't know. Brilliant. I have no idea. So my last question to you is this.
Are we really done almost, by the way? Is this
It's literally like...
Can we just go on for 2 hours? Yes, I feel like I could just...
Forever.
Okay, perfect.
You know, news broke out recently about Sam Sifton's, you know, au revoir to the New York Times dining section. And everyone who's in the food media is like, oh, yeah, who's it going to be? Is it going to be a girl? Is it going to be a guy? You know, who...
It's me.
It's you.
I'll say it. I'll come out right now. It's true.
That's why I had you on the show. I wanted to figure that out.
No, it's true. Okay, continue.
But,
sorry.
You know, maybe not necessarily like who do you want to see there, but what's the kind of editorial voice or perspective you'd like to see in the dining section?
Oh, boy. I think Sam Sifton brought some interesting things to the dining section. I mean, I think he engaged like a part of New York, or like a certain type of person that wasn't interested in dining, that maybe hadn't been reading the, you know, the reviews in recent years. And I think he was also really polarizing to a lot of people, and he was seemingly unpredictable with some of the things that he said and some of the stars that he gave. I think it was hard for restaurants and chefs. They really didn't know what to expect from him. And I think that's fantastic in a way. But also as a reader, it just puts you in a strange place, not knowing exactly where he's coming from on every single thing, and like having a kind of sense of a reliable narrative eye. But he was definitely, he had a style and a voice that I think was exciting. And that might be sort of lacking from some of the other dining section coverage. I mean, the New York Times is obviously a fantastic place for news, and they're telling interesting stories, and it's well reported, and it's factual, you know, and you can trust, if it's from the Times, that it's something that's you know, an accurate representation of what the story really is. I feel like, but I feel like for where they need to go next, they need to, I'm not sure who that person's going to be, but they talk about, you know, having an insider, having a what you know, like this. But I think we need to have somebody that just has, you know, a level-headed focus on food and culture, and not too much in either direction, not too much on just the scene or just the food. I hope they wouldn't, you know, respond to some of the backlash that Sifton was only about the atmosphere of the space by hiring someone who's a strict food writers, you know, only writing about food, because I think those things are really important. And while sometimes he might have gone too much in one direction, I think that bringing those two worlds together is really, really an important part of what the next person needs to do at the Times.
So you're saying they should hire Brett Michaels?
That's what I'm
probably
saying.
Yeah.
Or again, I'm available. Not really. This is live. Are people listening to this? Is this
they
real?
Are, okay. They well, are. So
you know, whatever.
New York Times, if you're listening,
I'll do it.
Matt is available.
I'll do it.
Well. Matt Ducker, thank you so much for coming on the show
today.
Thank
you so much for having me. And you're doing a great job here, by the way. I really do think radio is I was telling you before the show, I listen to podcasts and radio all the time. Well, pretty much only podcasts. Who has a radio? But I really do think it's a great art form, and the long form interview is really fantastic. And so thanks for, you know, being here and doing this and bringing on interesting people and people like me who shouldn't probably be here. I don't know why I'm here, but
Chris
thank you
Farley
for giving
on a
me
Japanese
a
Japanese game show.
Right. Yes. Right.
Well, no, seriously, thanks so much for coming on. And yeah, we loved having you. And if you haven't seen The Feast, it's thefeast.com, right?
That's thefeast.com, and that will take you to our site. Yeah.
And your Twitter?
My Twitter is @MattDucker, and our Twitter is TheFeastNY for The Feast. But you can follow me at @MattDucker.
It's the best. I'm Helen Holliman. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of You Look Hungry. Thanks to Jack Inslee, the crew at Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's. I'll see y'all next week.
Let's go out to eat and get some meat. Turkey and jam, macaroni and ham. Say, do you like steak? I can surely make. If you hear me now, sing it loud from the crowd.
for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The Heritage Meat Shop has just opened in the Essex Street Market. Open from 9 to 7 Monday through Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sundays, the Heritage Meat Shop supports independent family farms and animal welfare approved and certified humane raising standards. Most importantly, they offer a wide variety of heritage breeds. So stop by, get a sandwich, try the charcuterie, the Heritage Meat Shop at the Essex Street Market. The following is a message from Heritage Foods USA. 14 family farms and over 50 restaurants have committed to participation in No Goat Left Behind, a new program developed by Heritage Foods USA, a meat distribution company dedicated to preserving endangered breeds. Without an end market, the majority of male dairy goats are sold into the commodity market or killed at birth. Dairy farmers are always struggling with feed prices, milk prices, and weather. Goats usually have twins or triplets, and for every female who will become a milker, there is a male buckling who will become a financial drain. It makes no sense that these males are sold into the commodity market or put to death when the United States imports almost 50% of its annual goat supply. Home consumers interested in participating can order goats through heritagefoodsusa.com. They will receive goats via FedEx, and home delivery is available for New York City customers. In addition to the goat, these packages will also include recipes and a DVD featuring interviews with the farmers, processors, and chefs demonstrating how to break down and cook goat. Again, for more information on No Goat Left Behind, visit www.heritagefoodsusa.com or call Aaron Fairbanks at 718-389-0985.